ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm David Claughton, and this is A Big Country. Thanks for tuning in for a trip around regional Australia. This week, it's harvest time for many Aussie farmers, and we'll check in on a pretty special harvest with a lavender grower who's picking the fragrant purple flowers by hand. We'll visit a quirky golf course in a spectacular setting on a remote island that's bringing the community together in camaraderie. And we'll learn about some very clever conservation dogs and hear how they're being used to sniff out freshwater turtle nests to help preserve the native species. They work in short bursts with well-earned rests in between.
That sniffing that they're doing takes up a lot of energy. It's not just the physical, as in the legwork of it. It takes a lot of brain power for them to do it as well. They're really focused and on the job. So, yeah, and us handlers probably need a bit of a break as well. Yeah.
Tiring work for dogs and their handlers. We'll hear more about that conservation project coming up. Forget the selfies with pretty purple jacarandas or brilliant yellow sunflowers. White coffee tree blossoms are arguably even more spectacular. But to capture the sight, you've got to get in quick, as they only last for 2 days. Reporter Kim Honan was lucky to drop into a coffee plantation at Newrybar near Byron Bay on the New South Wales north coast, just in time to see the blossom. She spoke to grower Rebecca Senfeldt.
It is a beautiful and very special 2 days. The blossoms are on. You've got to come visit.
And why does it only happen like 1 or 2 days of the year?
The blossoms come in spring after a significant dry spell, which we've had 8 weeks or so. And then the rains come, which they did last week. And on the 10th day, the flowers come out. So it has pretty much been on the 9th or 10th day today. So, and the blossoms on the coffee trees do only last 2 days. Then they drop. And then that tiny little bud of the next fruit starts to grow for the next 11 months into. It's got to last all the way till next October.
The blossoms are white, but can you give a better description of what they look like and maybe what they smell like?
Yes, Kim, the coffee blossom is really like a little star jasmine or orange or citrus blossom. And they smell extraordinarily sweet like a jasmine. That's the best description, citrus or jasmine blossom. And as I say, only 2 days, so it's very special. So you can just go right up to a tree. In fact, we've had people drive by a couple of years ago and have their windows down and come in on the day that the blossoms were out because they could smell the blossom in the air. Yeah. It is a beautiful, sweet fragrance. So yeah. I hope those who visit will to come and smell the blossom at least.
And the bees are absolutely loving the blossoms. They're everywhere.
Yep, they're going crazy. That's often what we do is hear the bees first, the hum. They will be out in force. I mean, they're not interested in us, so I'm not worried about being stung. They're just focused in on getting that nectar out of the middle of that gorgeous little blossom. The bees love it. It's a very bee-friendly farm or bee-friendly industry, so I love that for the Australian coffee industry.
So a very limited time to come and see the blossoms on the coffee trees. Do you get a lot of people here at the plantation wanting to take selfies with the coffee trees?
I think they should. I think it's just marvellous. It is extraordinary. We think this has been the 38th lot of flowering. No, I exaggerate. The trees are 38 years old, so we probably had 34 years of coffee blossoms. And we think this is the best in at least 6 years. Remember 2019 was so dry. It was really a drought season for the northern rivers or the north coast of New South Wales. And that's when we had a serious lot of flowers after that dry. And that's what we've got again after only 8 weeks.
So this amount of blossoming, do you reckon it's going to be a bumper crop next year?
Oh, we deserve it to be. We really would hope so. Yeah. I mean, every flower won't turn into a little fruit. We will allow some to drop and accept that. But it's a really good start. You know, you've got to start with the blossom before you get the fruit. So, yes, it makes sense that we should see a good crop come through next year. Let's hope we can keep the crop on and get a super harvest in 2026.
Well, I was hoping to get here for harvest. Turn up, the harvest is just done. Blossoms are out. How was harvest?
Harvest was smaller than we wanted. A little bit of sad face here. With that 8 weeks of the dry, it was just longer than we thought. And John really likes to let the trees relax with a bit of rain before we harvest. We do use our harvesting machine. If you're hand picking, you could hand pick every day for about 3 months. Well, we're not going to do that. We really can't make money as a professional farm to do that hand picking for the size of our, you know, sort of 40 acres, 16 hectares or so of coffee trees. So we just had to wait for the rain to come. But meanwhile, You know, some fruits dropping on the ground, and then you get a bit of a storm through and more fruit drops on the ground. We were very fortunate to miss the hail that came through a few days ago that unfortunately for those in southeast Queensland got it. So we were very grateful, fingers crossed, that didn't happen last weekend. So we have only done quite a small harvest on our farm this year.
And given the potential bumper crop next year, how good will that be given the demand and the prices for coffee at the moment?
Yeah, we need it. Australia needs more growers, and we've got a growing industry now. You know, we understand that we've got these new varieties, which we're really excited for. So we've got new growers planting. So we're coming in each year. I do feel, fingers crossed, we're on a roll now with new growers coming on board, and not just a bumper harvest next year. There's demand for it. There's roasters crying out for it. And that's just in Australia. You know, the specialty roasters are really looking for a specialty Australian crop. And they're willing to pay the money for it, which is a wonderful thing to keep our growers going and profitable. It's what we want.
And we're seeing more growers put in trees further south?
Yes, not just northern New South Wales, but the mid-north coast, more down Coffs and Port Macquarie way, which is terrific to see. There's interest there along the coast and in their hinterland. And then going right up into Queensland, right up to the tropical coast, which is exciting to see. Oh, Western Australia, we're expanding.
And are these new farmers to agriculture, or are they, you know, are they pulling out other crops to put in coffee, or they're just, you know, yeah, new to the industry altogether?
We're now getting quite a few professional farmers who may have been growing macadamias, that have been growing citrus in Western Australia and avocados in Western Australia, sugarcane in North Queensland, and they've had their issues with industry. Peanut farmers, where the local mills have closed down for both sugarcane and peanuts. So this, the professional farmer is joining us, which is really good because they'll be putting in on scale. You know, they do the maths and they work out that this is a crop that's in demand and should be profitable. And I'm going to really say in demand for the long-term future, not just import replacing as we are, but real good chance for export growth.
Are the new growers able to put in the new varieties that have been trialled?
We've all got access as members of the association, just to a small amount, because we are excited about the new varieties being available, but we're limited with the amount of supply we've got from the Alstonville trial block and also up in Walkham in North Queensland. So with that limited supply, Joss has been able to allocate just a small amount for each of us who are putting our hand up to be able to purchase, you know, 200 to 500 per variety. But there's four varieties, so at the max is only 2,000 trees per year, but each year we'll be able to get more. And after 4 years, of course, they're open pollinating varieties, open sourced, and they will be self-pollinating, sorry, is the right word. So we'll be able to then collect our own fruit and then grow the industry from our own fruit from our farm.
And you've got a couple of the new varieties that are four-year-old now that have just exploded with white blossoms.
They are a fantastic example. I was very fortunate to receive those as an early gift from our agronomist, David Peasley, so I chuffed to him. Yes, they're extraordinary amount of flowers. And the Marsalesa, there's Marsalesa and IPR 107, the Marsalesa new varieties out today, and the flowers are bigger, the blossoms are bigger than the main two varieties we grow in Australia. So that's going to be interesting to see if that equates to overall bigger sized fruit or bigger sized coffee bean inside.
Wow, bigger cherry, bigger coffee bean. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, maybe. I hope so. I'll look tomorrow. So, you know, on Friday we'll be able to see all the flowers out. So I'll compare flower size and we'll have a judgment and see what happens next year when we get the fruit off the trees in October, November 2026.
On the fairways of Truwana, Cape Barron Island, things are a little unexpected. You won't find any tailored trousers or neatly pressed polos here, but you'll score an advantage if a crow steals your ball. And while some players have a decent shot, it's safe to say no one on this island is turning pro.
It's a place to come and nobody worries about anything except the golf, because they know me. And I want people to relax, and we don't have no carry on or anything like that.
That's John Gardner. For this golf course, he's everything.
Greenkeeper, the manager, the organiser, player, do everything.
A few times a week, you'll find John on the mower, tending the course he's been instrumental in creating. It's called the Marijuana Golf Course.
It was a bit of a play on words for me, and it's different.
John assures me the club doesn't promote drugs, but it makes for an interesting sign. And John likes his signs. They're dotted around the course marking the names of holes. Some are funny, like the long drop. Others pay tribute to community members who have died. Trawana Cape Barron Island sits off the northeast coast of Tasmania. It's home to around 80 people, most of whom are Indigenous. The Tasmanian government handed this land back to the Aboriginal community in 2005. Now, the island is run entirely by the community, the only place in the state that's governed this way.
Oh, beautiful!
Golf is a tourist draw card for Tasmania. Over on King Island, Cape Wickham Links was recently named the best golf course in the country by Australian Golf Digest. A game there will set you back hundreds of dollars in greens fees. The views at Marawana rival that of any prestigious course in the country. You can see beautiful wild hills, clear blue waters, and the mountain range on neighbouring Flinders Island stands on the horizon. But like the land it sits on, this course isn't meant for rich tourists. John made it for locals, and both entry and golf clubs are completely free.
It's all set up to not make things too hard for anybody.
On the weekend I visit, there's a memorial game for a much-loved community member who died a few years ago.
I'm Brooke Burke. So today I was the first female to win the Sharon Shuffle Pairs Championship. I've been coming here for 3 years doing the championship since my auntie passed away, and we do this game as a tribute to her, and today I won.
How's that feel?
Great.
Every Friday, there's a hole-in-one competition. Local Luana Towney is a regular, and like many people here, the first time she played golf was on this course.
It doesn't matter if you're good at golf or not. People support you 100%. People laugh at each other and laugh at themselves, which is the main thing.
One of the best players on the island is Tim Maynard. His name holds multiple coveted spots in the shed that serves as a clubhouse. But Tim's not in it for the glory.
I reckon it feels better when someone else gets a good shot and celebrate and I join in it. Yeah.
And that pretty well sums up the spirit of this golf course. Everyone has a go, no matter your ability or agility. Unconventionally, John's actually put backboards on some greens to give people a better chance. And he's always there to coach, even me.
Too far. I reckon you're standing too far away from it. That's better. Well, you're on.
We're on.
Buck Brown is a senior ranger on the island. He says this place is about more than golf.
A lot of camaraderie in the sense of one of the strongest things I've seen in this community, actually pull the community together, has been this golf club. In a way, I've seen it get a lot of people out of the houses in the community. Well, it's actually got them out of the house and out walking on country.
And for John, he's pretty pleased when he sees people enjoying his course, and he gets a lot of joy from being out here too.
Especially the day after I've mowed. Because there's a certain smell out here then when you've got fresh cut grass and especially you come out in the morning, the sun's shining and all the mountains are on, you know, it's beautiful.
You can do it all night long.
That story from Louise Moylan on Truana. And there's a great video on that golf course. Search ABC Cape Barron Island and you'll find it. I'm David Claughton with you for A Big Country. Still to come, we're meeting a former nurse who stumbled into growing lavender and now runs a flower farm alongside a thriving agrotourism business. And we're heading to the Lower Murray River in South Australia's Riverland region, where conservation dogs are being deployed to sniff out freshwater turtle nests. The native freshwater turtle population has declined significantly in recent years, and it's hoped by detecting nests, baby turtles can be saved from predators. Conservation dog handler Fiona Jackson told Anita Ward what's involved in training the dogs.
It takes a bit of work, but what we're doing with our three dogs here is we're getting substrate from the natural environment and adding some colloquial fluid, some turtle fluid to the substrate, and training with the dogs that anytime they sniff out that odour, they get rewarded. So anytime they sniff out, they get rewarded with either a little bit of food or their absolute favourite thing, which is a ball.
Why are they such a good tool in the detection process?
Dogs in general as a methodology, because of their sense of smell, it's just so incredible. People say researchers say it's anywhere between 10,000 and 100,000 times better than our sense of smell. So anything that we're struggling to find in the natural environment, like turtle nests, you can deploy a dog that technology of their sense of smell can be a real aid in finding those nests or anything that's really difficult for us as humans, either as spotters or other methodologies that struggles.
How effective are they in finding the nests? I know it's a relatively new process.
Yeah, so we are still training. We've just started this week. Actually, in fact, last week we just introduced the dogs to the odour. So the training wheels are very much still on for our three. But that being said, there's other groups around Australia and across the world who have done this successfully. So it can be done. People up in New South Wales, over in Western Australia, and even in Victoria, actually, who have all successfully worked with conservation detection dogs to find turtle nests. So we're confident that once our lot are trained up, they'll be able to do the same and help out here.
How long is that training process?
In terms of scent imprinting the dog on the odour, it takes a couple of weeks. Then you've got to get the dog out, which is what we're doing this week, is get the dog out in the natural environment, get them used to this environment. And it then becomes very much a process of calibrating the dog across all the different odour possibilities and complexities that there are in the natural environment. So it's hard to say, but in terms of if you have a brand new dog, if you have a dog from pup, it can take anywhere to 12 months to 18 months to get a dog up and running. But thankfully, the dogs that we put on this project are already experienced. So they have all their safety and welfare instructions in place. So they're very safe in the natural environment, which is super important to us. So we're hoping after a month or two of training on this odour specifically, that they'll be ready and really calibrated to the odour to help and do searches in the natural environment here.
And tell us about the dogs involved. Who are they and how successful have they been so far in getting that imprint?
So the dogs, we've got three dogs on this project, two very experienced dogs who are called Oakley and Rex, who are actually out with us in South Australia at the minute because they're also on the Murray Darling Carpet Python project, which is what we've been doing this morning. And they're super experienced dogs and have quite a few different threatened species odours that they're already on. And they are scent imprinting now to three different turtle species. So the broad shell, the eastern long neck and the Murray short neck. And then we've got a slightly younger dog, Aaron, who's 3 years old. This is his first threatened species project, but he's very experienced and helps us out in our renewable energy projects. And he is also just absolutely nailing his scent imprinting. So we're really excited to take these training odours that we have and start putting them out here where we are at the minute down by the lake and having him and the other two go out and start searching around here.
It's amazing work that you're doing and the dogs are doing. Once they're fully trained for the turtles, what does a day of turtle detection or nest sniffing out look like for them?
Yeah, there's definitely, they can go, what we tend to do is we get up at very early, we're actually up at 3:30 this morning to get up, to drive to site, to be ready at first light to do our Murray Darling carpet python searches. And it'll be the same for turtles. It'll be up as soon as possible. And they can usually go, dogs can tend to work, it really depends on the terrain and the temperature, but 2 to 3 hours is a good time, and then they can have a nice rest and maybe do the same again in the afternoon or evening. And they can probably do that for 2-3 days, and then they'll require a little rest and then do it again. But because it's a lot of work, that sniffing that they're doing takes up a lot of energy. It's not just the physical, as in the legwork of it. It takes a lot of brain power for them to do it as well. They're really focused and on the job. So yeah, and us handlers probably need a bit of a break after 3 days as well. Yeah,
I can imagine. Once they're ready to go on this turtle project, how confident are you they can help out with the conservation efforts here in the river and along the Murray?
I am probably quietly confident, only because the folk that have done this already in Australia, there's people that have done this and proven it. It's not like we're doing a proof of concept here. So those detection dog handlers that have done this already, and we're good friends with them, have given us the confidence as well. And they've really helped us in knowing exactly how to train the dogs, how to get the best outcome. So let's say quietly confident.
It's a pristine spring morning when I visit Anne-Marie Manders, a lavender grower from Wandin in Victoria's Yarra Valley. We're going for a stroll through her rows of purple lavender plants.
The two main lavenders that we do grow on a commercial basis is an intermediate lavender, which has a gorgeous camphoraceous fragrance and is wonderful for keeping moths and silverfish out of your wardrobe. and it flowers and is ready for picking at the end of December into January. The other lavender that we grow is an angustifolia lavender, and that is a lavender that you can use in food products, drinks, teas, ice cream, scones, biscuits, cakes, herb breads, all those sorts of things. Now, with the edible lavender, it is ready for picking at the end of November. So there is a month between when we pick the edible lavender and when we pick the non-edible lavender. Now, that was more a matter of good luck rather than good management in my case, because I knew nothing about what I was doing.
That's because Anne-Marie never dreamed of becoming a farmer. In fact, she had a whole other career as an operating theatre nurse before she and her late husband decided to buy an old cherry orchard. 35 years later, the property now stands as a thriving lavender farm, attracting flower lovers from across Australia and beyond. And here's what Anne-Marie tells them about the harvest process.
Now, when we pick the lavender, it's all picked by hand with a sickle, a small sickle, which is what the strawberry growers use. And it's a curved knife with a very sharp serrated edge. We start very early in the morning, at the latest at 6 a.m. If it's going to be a really, really hot day, we'll start at 5:30. And that's when the lavender has got its strongest fragrance. Having picked it in the bunches are picked by hand, a rubber band is put on the bunch. We then stack all those bunches into big picking bins, and then we transport those bins up into the drying shed where they are hung upside down to dry. And in amongst it, all that lavender, you've got a bit of stick and a bit of leaf, and there's also some flower dust. Now, you don't want that in your lavender if you're going to be putting it into food, or if you're going to be, if it's craft work, you're going to be putting it into little sachets or sleep pillows. So we sift it, and we have a series of three sieves, and we pour the lavender through, and it sits in a big bin, like a rubbish bin, and we shake it around. It's all done by hand. And people say, oh, this could be much, you could automate this and have it on a shaker table. But it doesn't, it's not hands-on. And I'm doing it more like the cottage industry, wanting people to see how it was done in the olden days. And I'm a bit olden day sort of in my approach. And it gives people a wow factor. And then they can put their hands into that stripped lavender, rub it between their hands and smell it. And it is gorgeous.
And so now, Emery, you've got about 12,000 plants,
yes,
on the farm?
Yes.
And you started with how many?
500.
Did you expect the farm to get so big?
No, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about running a business. I didn't have a tractor. I had no knowledge. And as far as making product, I didn't have a clue. And then I had to learn about how to price it. How was I going to talk to people? Yeah, it started off absolutely at the bottom of the ladder.
And so coming back to harvesting and processing the lavender, so the fragrance and the oils, they're actually contained in the flowers themselves?
Yes, the actual oil is in the base of every little, tiny, weeny little flower head. So if you look at the formation of a flower head, it's got a whole lot of little heads within that big head. And every one of those little heads has got a microscopic sac at the bottom, and that's where the oil is.
Anne-Marie says most of her customers don't know much about lavender, but she's set on changing that.
Some of them want to buy some plants to put in the house as an indoor plant. That's a definite no-no. So that's where I actually teach them that lavender is an outdoor plant. Secondly, it needs full sun, must have full sun. Thirdly, you do not water it. So you treat it almost with neglect. However, you do need to cut it back once a year and cut off those flower stems and trim it down into a neat, tidy bush, and then it goes into a dormancy. Unfortunately, lavender will not grow in the tropics. It's too humid, and people that come from Singapore or Asia, these countries, and want to grow lavender, I say, no, if you want to grow lavender, sell up and come and live in Victoria.
Anne-Marie Manders, she's a lavender grower in Victoria's Yarra Valley, where she spoke to reporter Faith Tabaluyan. And you can read more about that story. You'll find a feature article on the ABC website at abc.net.au. Just search for ABC Lavender. That's the show for today. I'm David Claughton, and I'll catch up with you again next week with more great stories from regional Australia. I'll chat to you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.